WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
ITdeals.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Hornets put this town on the map in the professional sports world from the start. They filled the Charlotte Coliseum. Remember that building? Even when they didn't have a ghost of a chance of winning. Then the team spit on our affections and left town for New Orleans. After years playing there, the team's new owner wants to change the name. Would that mean the Charlotte Bobcats might toss its name and bring the Hornets' name home? We contemplate the possibility and implications of that later in the program. First, counterfeiting and forgery, not of money or documents, but of fine art. It is a big business and a despicable one, with vast sums of money sometimes changing hands for a totally worthless forgery. It's something that museums, galleries, and artist foundations are dedicated to fighting. The Beckler Museum of Modern Art is one of those museums, although they don't have to fight it because their entire collection came directly from the artists themselves, but they are currently exhibiting the works of Alberto Giacometti. The Swiss artist holds the distinction of having created the most expensive sculpture ever sold at auction. It brought $104 million, and that makes other works by Giacometti ripe for forgery, but not if Veronique Wiesinger can help it. She is director and chief curator of the Paris-based Alberto and Annette Giacometti Foundation. She spends much of her time fighting fraud and counterfeiting, and she joins us now from Paris, France, the first guest we've had from Paris. Thank you for being here this morning.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. And with us in our Spirit Square studio is John Boyer, President and CEO of the Beckler Museum of Modern Art. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Mike.
The Giacometti exhibit is at the museum right now. It plays, or it doesn't play, but it is there through February the 8th. And it's something that people should see. This is a relatively remarkable collection.
Well, it is. We're very lucky to be able to show important works from our core collection by Alberto Giacometti with some other pieces by his two brothers, Diego and Bruno. One was a decorative arts artist, and the other was an architect.
And there's some plasters in this that have not been shown before that were shipped over from France, correct?
Oh, and this is just an example of the remarkable generosity of the Giacometti Foundation in Paris. And Veronique and her team have been extraordinary in helping us build this show. And these plasters are exceptionally fragile. They are unique in, of course, the truest sense of the word. It's the first time that they've been in the United States that I'm aware of. And we couldn't be prouder to have them in the context of so many other works by this titanic figure from mid-20th century modernism.
The purpose of this conversation is to talk about forgery. But when I read about these plasters, and you've just said they're exceptional and rare, and Veronique, I'm just curious how you ship these things, I mean, across the Atlantic.
Lots of
bubble wrap.
We use special crates, and of course, it must be very special. So, but it's difficult, but it's not unmanageable. And I consider that it was important to let people understand how sculptures are made. And of course, bronze is beautiful, and bronze is the material that Giacometti intended to be the final one. But to really understand how he worked, you have to see the plaster also.
Now, let's talk about counterfeits and forgeries, because as I said, the Giacometti sculpture that sold for $104 million set the bar pretty high for artists, but also for the collection itself, and makes his works a prime target for forgeries and counterfeits. How big a problem is this in the art world around the world, Veronique?
Well, it's getting just enormous and out of control. You know, forgery has always existed, and actually the first forgeries that we have in our records date from Giacometti's own lifetime, so it's nothing new. What is new is the scale of this huge scam, because the e-commerce, you know, commerce on the internet is making things just impossible to control. It's terrible.
Does this affect only big-name artists with valuable works like Picasso and Renoir and Matisse, or would it affect a regionally well-known artist or somebody lesser known than those folks?
It affects all artists whose works are selling for a lot of money, and some of them are not known outside of Europe or the U.S., but they're very well known in their own country, and they're faked in their own country. So it's a global phenomenon, really global.
This has been going on, obviously, long before the Internet. Does the Internet make it far worse? And if so, why?
You know why? Internet makes it far worse because of the legal implications. That today we have laws that are governing each country, but the e-commerce makes commerce a global thing, and it's just something we have not been able to face until today, because things are offered for sale in one country, they can be bought in another country, they were going to be shipped through other countries, and there are lots of conversations about this at every level of government in Europe and also at an international level. And I think we're not close to any conclusion because there is this problem of confusion between what is immaterial and what is material. And this is why we fight so that the material character of artworks should be recognized as an intrinsic part of what they are. Because it's really like any merchandise, even though it's a very respected and important one, but it's a merchandise and it can be shipped. And so it's exactly like an infringement on trademark.
Now, I once bought a Cartier watch on the streets of Manhattan for $13, and I talked them down from $25. Now, that's obviously a forgery. It looked just like a Cartier watch. It had Cartier's name on it. I knew it wasn't, but I bought it, and it was $13. How can you go wrong? But why would somebody or how would somebody know what they're buying unless it was represented as an original Renoir? Then I think you would have to say, is it really? But you'd probably be buying that, would you not, from a reputable firm?
There is a big difference between a Cartier watch and an artwork, because most of the trade of artworks is second-hand, of course,
right?
Because, you know, the work is sold once and then it's going to be sold and resold for the centuries to come. So most of it is uncontrollable by the originator of the work. And second, nobody really cares about what the Cartier watch will be like in 200 years from now, but we care about what Giacometti works will be like in 200 years from now. So we have a very special commitment to ensuring that the heritage of the artist is going to be respected and protected for the centuries to come.
Now, John, you don't, as I said in the beginning of the program, the Beckler doesn't have to worry about this because most of the collection came through the Beckler family, and they bought these works of art directly from the artists with whom they had personal relationships over time. But other museums do buy and sell works of art. And when they buy, when individuals of relatively high income, because we're talking about some of these works of art being in the millions of dollars, buy works of art, one would presume that they go to a legitimate source for their art and they get certificates of authenticity or they get the provenance of the work of art. How can these big institutions like museums and big collectors who are relatively savvy be scammed?
Well, and in fact, they can be scanned. First of all, to answer your question, it really is about a depth of connoisseurship, that you have staff and advisors who are exceptionally well-trained and know these pieces, know these artists, know the period, know the material exceptionally well. So that's the predicate. You start with that. But even in those circumstances, with great collectors, for example, a forgery can advance all the way through the state of purchase, very often if it's been endorsed by a particular gallery. Now, there's a kind of a terrifying tale out of New York City with the Nodler Gallery, which had been operating for a century, recently had to close under the weight of pending court cases because it was clear to many, although not yet proven in court, clear to many that they were selling works of the abstract expressionist of America like Jackson Pollock and others, and very likely now to be fake.
And did they know they were selling fakes?
Well, I think this is the kind of thing that's going to be advanced in the court and see exactly who knew what at which point during this process. But it's clear that the works that emerged from that gallery are not the real thing. And yet tens of millions of dollars were spent by, again, as you said, savvy collectors.
And when you're buying a work of art, be you an institution or an individual, from a place like Christie's or Sotheby's or at auction, and they're coming from private collections around the world, how do you know that the work of art is genuine, particularly if it goes back 100 years, 200 years, 1,000 years in some cases?
And to Veronique's point, this is something that's been happening for a long time. We, you know, the terrifying stories about Rembrandt fakes that go way, way back, go back two centuries.
So not only is the artwork fake, but the certificate of authenticity and the history of the work and who owned it at what point is also doctored.
It can be, and they have been, although that's rare, but that's part of the issue. And in fact, I would say, if you'll allow me, that the Giacometti Foundation is becoming increasingly unique in its willingness to press this issue. That is to say, recently the Warhol Foundation, the Liechtenstein Foundation, and others have pulled back from their earlier role in authenticating works by their artists. To the contrary, the Giacometti Foundation has accelerated the work that they've been doing. It's very much now recognized on a global level. It's involved not only at the connoisseurship end, but at the lawmaking end. And Veronique and her team have been featured, you know, in everything from the Financial Times and just a couple of weeks ago in The Economist about this issue, because it is an absolutely terrible thing that will undo a huge market globally. But most importantly, it will, if not stopped, will erode the integrity of our cultural history on an international scale.
How do you explain something like the Warhol folks pulling back on
It's very straightforward. It's the cost of lawsuits. This is the issue, is that the legal exposure a group like these artist-based foundations take can be absolutely unnerving, terribly expensive if things go wrong. But even when you're defending yourself in a case that you win, you still have to spend the money for that kind of protection.
But if you don't fight it, you're devaluing the currency being the artworks.
And not only that, it is the currency, to be sure, on a monetary value, but more importantly, I would argue that it's the cultural value, that it is about the primacy of the object and its authenticity being unquestionable, and if that's eroded, then what's left?
There's a great story, well, it's a terrible story, about the Giacometti works of art. In 2009, more than 1,000 fake Giacometti sculptures were discovered in a German warehouse, which led to a multinational investigation. I only have about a minute and a half left here, Veronique, but can you sum up that story? Because it's remarkable.
It took many years of my life it's difficult to sum up, but the truth of the matter is that they are still made, you know, because they were made in Thailand and this goes on. So this is the lesson to learn, you know.
And they were being sold by this count who also turned out to be counterfeit.
Fake count, fake certificates, everything was fake. And we must be very clear, it doesn't affect only the rich, it also affects people with modest means who think they're investing in things that are going to last. So I think it's very, very important to say that, you know, not only the rich.
Yeah, you say that combating this problem is one of the things that you've done, but you said that the counterfeiters are vampires and parasites, and their work will slowly but surely suffocate creativity if we do not act. How does it suffocate creativity in 30 seconds?
Well, it's obvious that who would want to create something and put energy and money in it if it's going to be, as soon as it's out and having success, being appropriated by somebody else? Who would do that?
We have to take a break. We're going to come back with more on this situation with forgery and counterfeits in the fine art world. Veronique Wiesinger is the director and chief curator of the Alberto and Annette Giacometti Foundation. Many of the works on display at John Boyer's Beckler Museum of Modern Art. Coming back in a second. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Pearl Vision, providing annual eye exams, eyewear, and accepting major insurance plans, including iMed Vision Insurance. Details at pearlvisioncharlotte.com. Nobody cares for eyes more than pearl. Well, last year or this past year or this year, 2012, ushered in some memorable events here in Charlotte. Of course, we played host to the Democratic National Convention. Then there was Governor Bev Perdue's surprise decision not to run for re-election, and the election of former Charlotte Mayor Pat McCrory. John Edwards, do you remember this? I've forgotten completely about this. John Edwards had his day in court in 2012. We got a new school superintendent in 2012. People got angry over property revaluations, and the Bobcats became the losingest team in NBA history. We're going to look at some of the major events and not so flattering ones of 2012, Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Fiscal cliff negotiations appear stuck in neutral. The Fed ties interest rates to jobless numbers. The Michigan governor signs a right-to-work law. The week's top national stories, what happened and why.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Veronique Wiesinger joins us from Paris. She is the director and chief curator of the Alberto and Annette Giacometti Foundation. Many of the works of Giacometti are on display and have been on display because they're part of the permanent collection of the Beckler Museum of Modern Art, where John Boyer is president and CEO. But there's also a special exhibit going on now with extra works that have been shipped over from Paris. And we're talking about counterfeiting and forgeries in the art world. And I'm curious about how many people you think, Veronique, might own a work of art that is, in fact, they believe it to be the real Megilla, and it is, in fact, a forgery.
Hundreds of them, at least, maybe thousands of them.
And when it's discovered that somebody is in possession of a counterfeit or bought the counterfeit from a gallery or an auction house, do any of those people, are any of those people liable? As an owner of a counterfeit, are you liable for it if you're trying to sell it, even if you don't know it's counterfeit? Is the gallery, is the auction house liable if they're selling something that's a counterfeit, particularly if they don't know it is one?
Well, galleries are professionals, so they have the liability of a professional to take due diligence into checking the provenance and everything. For somebody who is not a professional, the liability is completely different. If I inform them that this is a forgery and that they should not put it up for sale or exhibit it or do something with it that would be public, and they still do it and we can prove it, then they're liable as well. So it really depends. It's on case-by-case basis.
But of those museums and of those individuals who may be in possession of works of art that they believe to be real but in fact are not, they must have bought them through reputable sources. How can you ever be certain that what you're buying is the real thing?
This is why we're trying to educate the museum professionals on the importance of checking with the foundations when they exist. Because you never know today. You know, I know very, very important collectors, and they have forgeries in their collection, so it might happen someday that they die, the information is lost, and they give the collection over to a museum, and in the collection you have really good things and you have bad things. So you need to check. And today, especially for well-known artists, it's become necessary to check.
I want to hear from both of you on this. This is kind of a crass question. But if you have a work of art that many people look at and say that's the real thing, and it's a work of great art, and it's by a great artist that everybody knows, and suddenly one day it turns out that it is not by that artist, is it not still a great work of art because it's passed the visual test? I mean, you've looked at it for years, people have examined it, and they say, yep, this is great, this is it, this is the real thing, and it turns out not to be... I know it matters in the scheme of things because it's not by that artist, but it's by somebody who's pretty daggone good.
Yeah, well if I may answer first.
Sure.
This is a question that we ask ourselves, but my answer is that if you go to a museum, you should be entitled to trust what you're shown. That is, if a label says that it's by Alberto Giacometti, you should trust that it is by him, and because you're going to learn to appreciate the artwork And this is a responsibility the museums have to educate people through the right thing. If somebody has something that they personally think is great and they keep it in their homes, it's completely different. This is my position.
And I agree completely. I think that the museum experience is sort of not the same as going to the movies, where you intentionally suspend disbelief and give yourself over to this narrative, right? When you go to the museums, your expectation is that you are engaging with the truth somehow, both at the sort of actual level of the moment, the object that you're looking at. But that allows you to arrive at higher truths about self-discovery and who you are and the larger frame of life and the flow of history and culture and all of those things. If it's not predicated on an accurate understanding of the engagement you're having at that moment, that that object is actually what they say it is, so much else is eroded about the experience you have in your life. And I would argue that the truth does matter, and it matters in this instance as well.
Now, there are forgeries and there are replicas, and the replicas are known to be just that, the real one sitting someplace, and this is a replica. But at some point, the real one could get confused, could it not, with a really good replica, and the replica could then be represented as a real thing, Veronique?
I don't know what you mean by replica. It's a very complex situation. If you're talking of some Roman replicas of Greek sculpture, you know, it's not exactly the same as replicas from the 17th century, and it's again completely different from a reproduction that would be made in the 19th century when there were these large editions of sculpture. So it's I think it's a bit too difficult to answer this question in a very short way.
Okay. You talk, Veronique, about the circuits of legitimization when a fraud goes from eBay to a mainstream gallery and even to a museum. That caught my eye because I thought, surely no museum buys a painting or a sculpture from eBay. And do serious collectors buy on eBay? Because you can go on the internet and find anything to buy and sell. So do people really use that as a channel of purchasing fine art?
Well, unfortunately, they do. And some people buy on eBay and then they resell to galleries pretending it's been in their family for generations. And then it's in the gallery and the collector will buy it in a gallery, in a bricks and mortar gallery. So this is the way things go today. I mean, money, the pressure of money is so huge, you know, making money on anything, especially since the crisis began, it's become really a big, big issue.
Your organization has been very active in trying to fight this. How aggressive is law enforcement, enforcing whatever laws are on the books around the world concerning the counterfeiting of fine art and the sale of that, and what kinds of punishments are in place when somebody is caught and convicted?
Very little, very little. And the enforcement is virtually zero. I mean, if you consider counterfeiting of watches or any luxury goods, it's so incredibly different. I mean, you can be caught and convicted on selling forgeries of watches or eyeglasses or whatever, and you do the same thing with the artworks, and you have no special units of police in most countries. You have no real recognition of the artist's estate being a victim, whereas we are going to have to clean up this mess for the centuries to come. You have all kinds of different approaches. In every country, it's different, and usually the risk is very, very minimal. So, and we need to change that. We need to have people respecting the artworks more than they do now.
Are there countries in the world that seem to do this better than others?
There are things here and there that are really good. You know, I mean, the specialized units in Germany, really good. But to go back to this German case, we had to fight 4 months before we were admitted in court as right owners that had been victimized. So Germany is definitely not a good example. And, each country has its pro and cons.
It's now aside
we
from
need
the
to have a global regulation on that because the market is global.
Now, aside from the fact that the articles on exhibit, the artworks on exhibit at the Beckler are the authentic artworks because we know where they came from and we can trace them directly from the hand of the artist to the museum itself. Aside from that, what is the significance of having this Giacometti exhibit on display through February the 8th?
Well, it's absolutely central to our mission as we use our exhibition program to celebrate the remarkable relationship that the Beckler family had with some of the most important artists of the 20th century without fail. And one of the most important stories we do get to tell is that relationship between Hans Beckler and Alberto Giacometti, and then later the ongoing relationship with both Diego and with Bruno. What makes the show so special, I have to say again, is the generosity of the Giacometti Foundation in Paris and the loan of 67 pieces as part of our exhibition. Drawings, paintings, sculptures in bronze and plaster. It's remarkable to have that body of work here in the States. It's been a long time since there's been a major Giacometti exhibition in the U.S., and it'll be a little bit while longer before there's another. So we feel particularly blessed because of their generosity, but it's an opportunity for us to help celebrate the Becklers as not only collectors but true patrons of the art and friends of these remarkable creative people.
John Boyer is president and CEO of the Beckler Museum of Modern Art. Veronique Wiesinger is director and chief curator of the Alberto and Annette Giacometti Foundation. She joined us from Paris, and the works of Alberto Giacometti are at the Beckler on display through February the 8th of 2013. Thank you both for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank
now,
you.
From the very first game they played and lost, the Charlotte Hornets, or the Charlotte Coliseum out on Tivola Road, Charlotte fell in love with the Hornets, even though they lost and lost and lost. In our minds, they could do no wrong. And we rewarded them by packing the building to the rafters and cheering on their sometimes hapless antics. The team's owner, George Shin, became a kind of local hero. Then he and his team stung us badly. They left us for another city, New Orleans. We fell out of love, and even when a new team arrived to take the Hornets' place, we just refused to commit. The Bobcats suffer from many things, the bad taste left in our mouths by the Hornets' departure, by their old owner George Shin, by former Bobcats owner the elusive and sometimes arrogant Bob Johnson, that new building downtown that voters rejected but the city built anyway, and of course last season when the Bobcats became the worst team in NBA history. So when the New Orleans Hornets' new owner was said to be thinking of a name change, some in Charlotte locked on to the idea of bringing that name back to Charlotte and pasting it on the Bobcats and their disrespected jerseys. Would that help? Would the fans return? Would we fall in love again just by bringing back the old name? Well, for those of you who weren't here in those heady, halcyon days of Hornet fever, it may be difficult to understand what that name means. The old team even had a song that was played on the radio. It was recorded by Billy Scott of Billy Scott and the Prophets of Beach Music fame, and we tracked down one of the few remaining copies on an old cassette. You know, it's amazing how technology has changed since the Hornets were around, as you are about to hear. A lot of people hated the song for reasons you will soon understand, but the song and its lyrics might give you an idea of how idyllically and blissfully head over heels in love we were with that team.
We love you, we love you, we respect you, Hornets. Thank you.
There you go. Off an old cassette, and it sounds like it. I want to thank David Eads and Harold Hamrick and our old friends over at WBT for helping us to find that song so we could play it for you today. And all the credit goes to the late Tom Desio, who I think twisted Billy Scott's arm into recording that song. So joining us to talk about the Hornets of old and the possibility of the return of the name and what it might mean to the team and the town is Scott Fowler, sports columnist for the Charlotte Observer. You were smiling during that song.
I had never heard that before, Mike.
You're one of the
fortunate. That was great. Yeah. I like the part about that. I don't know whether we don't care if you win or lose.
Yeah.
That shows you kind of what it was like,
and
I guess.
That's why I wanted to play it, because the lyrics of that song, I think, sum up the feelings that we had back then. And also with us is John Morgan, a 31-year-old elementary art teacher and Charlotte native and organizer of the Charlotte Hornets 2.0 movement.
That's right. That's right. I don't know. You guys are bagging on the song. I smell like Grammy. I thought that was the best thing I've heard this week.
Actually, I like the song, but then I liked Tony Orlando and Doug. So there you go. You were a kid when the Hornets were here?
I was seven.
You were seven
when they seven when they started. I guess I was 21, 22 when they left. I mean, the perfect time frame.
Yeah.
To grow up in this town.
And your father had season tickets and he took you to all the games?
I was a little kid, so we went to just a few a year, but then we started picking up as I got older. But yeah, I mean, we were there from day one. And
you were not here at the beginning.
Not at the beginning. I got here in 1994, so I missed the first, 5-6 years, I suppose. Although when I got here, they were a very good team, and at that point actually had, you know, that was when they were – had Alonzo Mourning, Larry Johnson, and were a team that was to be reckoned with, and actually, you know, and then I saw the bitter end. Yes, all the way through. I was at the very final playoff game and just watched it all, you know, the half full arenas for the playoffs, I was in the court TV courtroom sometimes for some of the court exploits as well.
So for a while now, there have been people who have been saying we need to bring back the name. You're wearing a We Believe.
It's the only shirt I wear. Yeah, it's pretty much a wardrobe of one.
Okay. Now the Hornets are maybe going to be changing their name to the Pelicans in New Orleans. So it actually is something that could happen, because if they didn't want to give up the name, they're not going to give up the name.
Right.
Is this more than a pipe dream?
Absolutely. And I say that coming from a place where it wasn't more than a pipe dream. 3 years ago when we started, it seemed like a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And
there are actually two groups that combined forces.
Bring Back the Buzz, a couple of brothers, also Charlotte natives, Evan and Scotty Kent. They run bringbackthebuzz.com. We've been working together. I do the We Believe, 2 E's, Charlotte Take Back Your Hornets Facebook page. And we sort of do everything in concert together. And It's not, you know, pipe dream. It was, you know, starting out, no reason to think it could happen, but the dominoes have fallen into place. And
we'll explore them in just a couple of seconds. Take a break and come back on the other side. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the professional MBA program at USC's Darla Moore School of Business, offering an MBA degree for working professionals in Charlotte. Details at 800-950-PMBA. Coming up at 10 o'clock at the Diane Rehm Show, Diane and a panel of journalists take a look at the week's top domestic stories. Fiscal cliff negotiations appear stuck in neutral. The Fed ties interest rates to jobless numbers. And the Michigan governor signs a right-to-work law. Those among other stories discussed in the 10 o'clock hour, the international hour coming your way at 11. on WFAE. If you'd like to join our conversation about the possible return of the Hornets, at least the name, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
I knew that when I finally had to say goodbye to Killian, it would be tough because he was such a huge part of my life. I had to schedule the time for him to be picked up as a time that I wasn't there because I would just lose it. It was just great to know that he was making radio now. He wasn't just sitting in my driveway. My name is Jessica Frazier. I donated my 1994 Chevy Lumina to public radio.
Learn more at WFAE.org, and thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. John Morgan is with us. He is the force behind Hornets, Charlotte Hornets 2.0.
One of the forces.
Scott Fowler, sports columnist with the Charlotte Observer. Now, I know John's behind this bringing back the name thing, and so are you, because you wrote an article about this. Why are you behind this?
I am. Probably not to the extent that John is, maybe. But I definitely think that while this has some oddities to it, I believe it's a little bit like dating your ex-wife, to go back to the original name, and you can imagine the problems that would cause in some ways. Ultimately, the name Bobcats, to me, Mike, has been very tarnished.
Yes.
From the beginning, with Bob Johnson and an even more ugly divorce there than there was with George Shinn, who in some quarters is viewed somewhat nostalgically now, and also wants the Hornets name to be revised, as my colleague Tom Sorensen wrote the other day. But I think it would be a good thing. I don't think it's a panacea. I don't think it would cure these terrible losing streaks the Bobcats keep going on. But I tell you, even now I'll watch ESPN or something, and they'll still occasionally call them the Charlotte Hornets by mistake. Or I'll go read an out-of-town newspaper, it'll still say Charlotte Hornets. That name got very ingrained for a very long time. I don't think the Bobcats have a whole lot of history that you'd worry about losing.
You know, it was magic for us. A lot of people come into town who are not here then. But let me just explain how magical this was. This was our first professional team. We felt like we were now important, that people around the country now recognized us as a force to be reckoned with. And in this part of the world, that's important.
Right.
It's always been important, and it happened. And then George Shinn hired Alexander Julian to design the uniform, which had these teal and purple colors, and it was very hip at the time.
Still is.
You would see the bug, the bee, all over the world, literally all over the world. People were wearing these insignias for the Charlotte Hornets. So it put it on the map worldwide. Creative Loafing wrote an article recently about this, saying, be careful about this, because the nostalgia may be swamped by the reality that occurs if the logo and the team colors come back. Do you worry about that?
I think I know the article you're talking about, and I read a lot. What I read into was, you know, a lot of sort of bagging on the idea that sort of treating nostalgia in a negative light. I've never understood that argument, that somehow being nostalgic.
Well, we have this wonderful warm place in our hearts for
right.
the Hornets and everything about them. If you're successful in bringing them back, you're pasting the name on a team we don't like very much.
Well,
will that sour us on the Hornets?
I don't think so. It's much more – what you would see is, for the first time, from a PR perspective, the Bobcats have, you know, over and over again, initially – yeah, I mean, initially anyways. And Jordan's doing a lot to sort of remedy some of those issues. But from the outset, they've sort of turned people off. They've aggressively – not aggressively, but they've unintentionally or not, you know, with CSET, the old TV network, from day one, they've sort of had problems. This would be a bit of a vindication to people. Like, you know, we're listening to you. We hear what you say as a community. We hear what you say as a fan base. Because it's, like you said, it's a worldwide thing still to this day.
Well, let me bring Jonathan into the conversation, because Jonathan is calling us, and I'm not sure how he feels about this, but we're going to find out. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good.
So the Hornets were never better than average, and so there's not really much to be nostalgic of, except the excitement of, you know, having a pro team in North Carolina, which was thrilling, but they were never better than average. And so why would we want to go back to that in that I found a hideous teal color.
Scott, I want to hear your perspective on this.
Well, you don't see teal very often anymore. You're right about Alexander Julian. At the time, with all the sweaters and everything, that was a very hot color. I would say the Hornets were somewhat better than average.
Yeah, absolutely.
Somewhat. That's all, though. They only won. They got to the second round of the playoffs. So the caller's point is well taken. They weren't an NBA championship team, and in some ways, you're never going to recapture the late '80s here. I mean, we got to remember, Mike. This was before the Carolina Panthers,
right.
And that was the probably one of the kill shots for the Hornets, because when the Panthers came in, and the NFL is the 800-pound gorilla of professional sports.
And they came in at about the time that the NBA was starting to get a little tarnished overall. I remember, because this was our first professional team, people filling the then new, now gone Charlotte Coliseum.
Yes.
Even though they knew there was no chance, they put on a show. And people would go and just love the experience. They loved it. And then we began trading players. And people got very upset because our experience in the Carolinas had always been with college basketball, where they don't trade the players. They are your guys. And suddenly people got up in arms because our guys were being traded. That shows you the innocence that we had back then. Is that what we're partly nostalgic for, our innocence?
Just back to the earlier point I was sort of addressing, you know, the nostalgia factor, it doesn't have to be. Of course, we are nostalgic for that earlier time when, you know, like the song said, wins and losses didn't matter, allegedly. And, you know, to the caller's point, he's talking about, you know, why would we want to rebrand as something that was only average, that only – this has nothing to do with really – attempting to place like an average.
You're having trouble.
I'm losing track. I'm trying to address so many different things. No,
that's all right. It wouldn't make the team play better.
It wouldn't make the team play better by any means.
Would it make us feel better?
I'd certainly think it would.
I think that's where it goes. You know, and the thing is, Mike, it's suddenly out there. I mean, the Pelicans, New Orleans is going to be the Pelicans. That's a whole different issue, whether you like that name or not. But ultimately, they're only going to spend $3 million to do this if they did it. That's not a lot of money in the NBA.
Well, you know, as cute as that bug is on his T-shirt, the idea of a pelican with a basketball in its hand, that's pretty darn cute.
I don't know if they're going for cute, though. But.
Probably not.
I think Pelicans is a great name.
I do, too.
I love it.
We asked our listeners what they think about a possible name change. Here's some comments. Mary on Facebook says, Charlotte and the Hornets go together, always a hornet's nest of rebellion and proud of it. That's something that really is true. That's where the name came from. Lord Cornwallis called this a hornet's nest of rebellious activity. And to take that name and pasted on a team in New Orleans doesn't make any sense.
Never did. Right. The Cornwallis thing that people, they refer to that with a lot of pride. And also there were, of course, a minor league baseball team that some old-time Charlatans remember that had that name for years. It's got a lot of history.
The logo of the police department?
Yeah.
It's all over the place. Light rail
stops. Yeah, it's everywhere. That's right.
Susan on Facebook writes, the Bobcats have plenty of bad karma. The Hornets will feel fresh and new to lots of folks who moved here since the arena unpleasantness. Plus, the team colors are so much nicer. Jonathan on Facebook, the Hornets name is special to this city, and if it is available, we should take it back. I know that I will be one of many who actually starts paying attention to the team if the name comes back. You think that's true?
Well, and that's a point that I hate to hear people, the best thing we can do right now is support this team that we have. You know, go out, cheer like mad for the Bobcats, because, you know, they've got a young core, they're doing what they can do to put an excellent product on the floor. So I hate to hear people say, well, you know, if they do it, then I'll cheer. But you've got to get that certain element in as well, you know, of fan.
Bob Johnson was never a hero. George Shinn was a hero. They gave this man a ticker tape parade when the team came to town finally. And then he gradually became this pariah.
Yes.
For many, many reasons, unrelated to basketball for some reason, because I think that's part of our innocence back
but
then.
Some of it was basketball, yeah. Mike, like you say, when they wouldn't pay Alonzo Mourning,
right.
And he left, that that made some of the relationships fizzle from a purely basketball standpoint.
And we felt that he was holding us hostage at the end because he wanted skyboxes, and since the old building couldn't be retrofitted for those easily, he wanted a new building, and we said no.
And the timing of his demands had a lot to do with the negativity thrown his way, too.
So he leaves, he takes the team and its name to New Orleans, we get a new team, we build the building that people don't want, and that set the Bobcats off on the wrong foot, I think, through no fault of their own.
Exactly, and I you know, the sort of the jilted lover
thing,
and you know, how do you just jump right into it without having some negative residuals?
So George Shinn is quoted in the Charlotte Observer last week as saying, the Hornets' name was never my name. It belonged to Charlotte.
Well, that's, you know, somewhat true.
Why did he take
it? Well, I think he took it because it was popular. But remember, they actually came up with originally the Charlotte Spirit.
Right.
That was supposed to be the original name, and everyone hated that. And so they went to the Hornets, which did have, as you say, the Cornwallis, the Revolutionary War history that so many of the people like to remember. That was part of the Hornets. So, yes, why did he take it to New Orleans, though? That's a good question. I never did understand that.
I think because maybe he did it deliberately.
Yeah, oh, he absolutely did.
He was
did.
Just angry.
Yeah,
yes,
he absolutely
probably
did.
So.
Heather on Facebook says, what's not to love about Alexander Julian having a hand in the colors? Hornets had a good time back in the day going to the games. There seems to be a lot of support for this out there.
All of John's friends have written in.
Yeah, oh, come on. I'm going to send her the five I have in my pocket.
Did you see this? Lloyd on Facebook, of course we should bring the Hornets' name back. The description of Charlotte as a hornet's nest goes all the way back to the Revolutionary War. General Cornwallis chose the name well. So did all the organizations that have a hornet's nest chapter. Even the team mascot's name, Hugo, is strongly identified with Charlotte, as any of us who endured the devastating 1989 hurricane can attest. Besides, this is personal with me. I still have my, from season one, great-looking 100% silk Charlotte Hornets necktie that I'd love to wear again. Now, that brings up another thing. A lot of us, me included, have Hornets paraphernalia tucked away. I brought three jackets
at them. They're beautiful.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they're very 1980s. I wouldn't be caught dead in them today. But I like them. They're white. One of them is black, but they're white with the purple and teal and the orange basketball. They're pretty cool looking. Style aside. So I have all this paraphernalia. Other people could bring it out of hiding if the name came back. But what about all the people who bought Bobcats material and paraphernalia? What about them? How would they feel about having to pack that stuff away or toss it?
Oh, that's some of the backlash, I think, for sure. I mean, the season ticket holders who have been loyal to the Bobcats now they're going on 9 years now, and they've got a closet full of Bobcat stuff.
Yeah,
although they have rebranded their colors a little bit, but still, I would think you'd have to have some sort of amnesty program where you can send some of your Bobcat if the Bobcats change it, you send it in. And you get, some free Hornets gear.
Didn't they do that when the Bobcats arrived? Didn't the Bobcats offer a trade-in on Hornets merchandise?
Did they?
I don't remember that. I think they did.
Maybe so.
I think they did, just to suck you into the fold here. An Observer poll this week showed that 77% of the people who responded to the poll have an extreme desire for the Hornets' name to return to Charlotte, with 12% saying that they would like it. Sort of.
That's weirdly.
How much did the Bobcats get to retain it?
It's like 5%, I think.
It was pretty low.
Yeah.
But that sounds like a ringing endorsement, John.
You're not going to, we just got through this harrowing political season. You know, you're reminded every day of our differences. You're not going to find a more universal consensus in this town, in this fan base, than our little initiative.
Cam Newton was seen at a Bobcats game wearing a Charlotte Hornets cap.
Next to Michael himself.
Now, how do you explain that? Where did he get the cap, first of all? Because it's a Charlotte Hornets cap, not a New Orleans Hornets.
The Charlotte Hornets brand, not New Orleans Hornets, but the Charlotte Hornets brand is still one of the number one sellers of, you know, the vintage gear movement. You see the kids wearing the snapbacks and the old sweatshirts and things. They're still a massive sale. I was actually in New Orleans this summer, and you go into the team store. They've got Saints gear everywhere.
Right.
They have one rack of Anthony Davis stuff, New Orleans' new superstar. no New Orleans stuff. They have a ton of Charlotte Hornets gear in New Orleans.
Now, how is that possible? Who owns
the brand?
The brand, the name, the logo, the actual B?
Well, the NBA owns all the, you know, the NBA, indeed, as David Stern said the other day, the NBA commissioner said, I have no problem if Charlotte wants to go back to the Hornets. They still own the brand, as they do all of the NBA, NBA.com and stuff like that. Can, you know, they have rights to sell all this stuff.
I noticed that you're wearing on your T-shirt, the We Believe T-shirt, you're wearing a slightly different version of the B. Is that because it's not licensed by the NBA, so it has to be different?
That's exactly why. Yeah, this is a friend of mine helped us out with these.
So are you advocating that we bring back the actual old logo?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
The old colors?
The whole shebang.
The old uniforms?
You know, I mean, if Muggsy wants to come, he can come too.
The old players?
Everybody.
What about the
Honey
guy,
bees.
The big fat guy who did the backflips and stuff and the timeouts? I always liked him.
So you're advocating a return of the whole shooting match. What's Michael Jordan's reaction to this?
He's open to it.
Very careful. Yes, I think.
Why so careful?
I think because of what you mentioned a minute ago, Mike, the backlash from his current fan base, which he wants to say, hey, look, thanks for sticking with us. I mean, they've only got about 8,000 season ticket holders right now. They'd like to have more than that. But those people have been loyal, and he wants to make sure, I guess but he understands. He played here when when it was so big, and he's always said he wants a home court atmosphere like that. But he has not said one way or the other. He has been very careful to straddle the fence.
He said when the name becomes available, it's something we'll look into. Whitfield, the president of the team, said that they were planning for the possibility of a name change. I mean, these are things you don't say if you're not seriously considering.
And $3 million doesn't seem like a lot of money in the scheme of things. No. Although I don't know how well they're doing for
that. You can't even get a good small forward for that
a
year.
We have 30 seconds left. You taped an episode of Jeopardy, John.
Yeah.
Has it aired yet?
January 21st.
And you wore an entire white Hornets suit, and they wouldn't let you do it on camera because it didn't...
It was messing up the HD cameras, right? But I did have a little I Love Hugo pin on, so they let me wear that. So, and they let me film my little promo shot in my Hornets getup.
How'd you do, by the way? Can you tell us? Or is that
can't talk about it yet. But.
John Morgan is spokesperson for Charlotte Hornets 2.0, and Scott Fowler is a sports columnist with the Charlotte Observer who thinks that Hornets' name should come back. So do I. There, I've said it. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks.